Welcome to Imagine This Podcast, where we discuss, celebrate, and highlight all of the excellent and abundant arts and culture in Milwaukee.
We hope that after listening to the pod, you'll see and experience our city and the incredible, vibrant arts and culture community in a new way.
I'm David Lee.
And I'm Mac Antigua. It's weird to have Tropical House playing when the leaves are starting to turn.
Our Tropical House will be the hope for a tropical future where we can be outside together, right? As the long hibernation happens.
That's your way of celebrating global warming. That's your way of hoping the Tropic of Capricorn or Cancer moves all the way up to our latitude. That's your way of saying that, right?
The water level on the river has been at an all-time high this year. I don't know if you know that.
I believe it.
Yeah.
I believe it. Third coast, man. Pretty soon, Omaha's going to
be. Wait, are we already the third coast?
That's what I mean. Omaha's going to have a beachfront. Kansas City's going to be sandy, is what I'm saying. And we're going to be Atlantis. Imagine Atlantis. That's what we're going to call our organization. We're going to be underwater.
I can't wait for that one.
2020 has already been a drag that it's already got me thinking about 2030 and how we'll be in an octopus's garden under the sea. Do we have to pay the Beatles for that? That I name checked that? Do we owe them like a dollar?
I think you said it in under 10 seconds, so that doesn't count.
Welcome back, listener. That's kind of our intimate opening here as we yet another edition of Imagine This Podcast. Excited to have you aboard and excited to have you with us as we muddle through 2020. And we're glad you're with us. It's a really cool episode. Later on the app, we're excited to have May Adralis from the Milwaukee Rep to talk about an event that's coming up shortly, which is 2020 Vision for the Arts. But before we get to that, little news and odds and ends.
So let's do the odds and ends first. Yes. So for those of you who listened to our episode last week, we put out a call to our army of listeners about how they prefer the butt ends of their bread. And
butt in the head.
Feedback appears that more people did not like Max wheat panada.
Yes, hot sandwich. Hot pocket.
Which I find surprising.
End zone.
That people actually look forward to it. It's not something that people just sort of eat because it's, you know, they don't want to waste bread. And also, actually, the other thing that I found surprising was the amount of people who willingly just waste food.
That like got your ire. That inspired your past life of working in hunger fighting immediately.
Correct.
You went into like that mode. Crank mode. You went right to woo. It's not pretty, but you were hectoring and lecturing people, and you could see them turn off, just literally turn off in real time.
Although one person, my friend Anthony, mentioned that he would use the butts of the bread to make French toast and or bread pudding. So there were other, you know, you could do other things with
friend of the pod, pieces. Christine Fleming, also shared that she will toast it. I think she shared and make it, I forgot what she said, or maybe I did. I was listening for this answer, croutons. You know, sometimes people are talking and I will just kind of go finish the thought for them, but they actually veer off another, they actually finish her actual thought. So she's listening going, no, I didn't say croutons. And I go to my mind like, oh yeah, I get it. Croutons. That totally makes sense. Sorry, Christine. I wasn't a very good listener in that moment. I wasn't on the job. I was just talking. Anyway, so that's odds and ends. We're tying up that loose end. Which is eat your ends and eat your ends with a smile and embrace it, everybody. I'm going to post recipes to the pod. I think we'll do some recipes for the.
But as is our want on this podcast, we are obviously burying the lead, which is state makes $5 million grant to arts and culture organizations.
Yes.
Incredible announcement last week.
You know, it's better than $1 million, David.
$5 million.
Do we owe Aaron Sorkin money for name checking the Facebook?
No, that came out in less than 10 seconds. Took us less than 10 seconds to do that.
Just making sure.
That reference. So,
but congratulations to us because it's so important. Because that's our job. That's why I exist to Hector. to make it easier to hector our steak.
Well, you know what I like? The thing that I really love about this, I mean, outside of the fact that there's going to be a $5 million grant program to the arts and culture sector, is that it makes the hashtag tan suit debacle worthwhile now.
So listeners, if you're just catching up, we had an article in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that called attention to this probably around Memorial Day, like right after Memorial Day, right? So first week of June, right-ish?
Yeah, Memorial Day weekend, yeah.
And the thing about it was this article really talking about the dire state of affairs and how we got to save our stages and all that stuff. And for some reason, they had a photo of you, or you either volunteered to be in a photo in a sunny day wearing a tan suit, smiling. Like, you couldn't pick a tonal discord greater than, like, the text was doom and gloom, but there you are, apparently Shore West's top seller for the month of June, moving so much property. You look like, you know. So that's why it's
hashtag called tan suit debacle,
because he wore this tan suit smiling. And I'm like, David,
every time
freaking now room on the article, dude, you shouldn't be smiling so widely.
Yeah. Well, every time I do an interview now, I defer to Lindsay about what photo it is. And we refer to it on our team chat as the hashtag tan suit debacle. Yeah, so
never again will we have that tonal discord.
So moment one, tan suit debacle. Moment two, the incredible Wisconsin Policy Forum study that came out a couple weeks ago, I think also called even more attention to this as well. And I think for those of you who have been listening, thank you for really tuning into the episode we had with Joe Pietrangelo, because that apparently has now launched us, or that episode is our most downloaded episode in the 33 episode history of our podcast.
Which I thought incredible. We had to wait for Joe Pietrangelo's exploits in the Eau Claire music industry to get that booster. But thankfully it was his day job that made it.
No, it's, yeah, absolutely.
That was our sweeps week stunt. That was our Fonzie jumping the shark. But in all seriousness, you know, since your tan suit debacle, we invited our network to write to our electeds, and over 1600 pieces of correspondence have been emailed to our state and federal reps since then. Since Memorial Day, since tan suit debacle. And, you know, again, it's pounding the rock, right? It's constantly getting in your ears and saying, what are we going to do for these stages? Of course, the other campaigns like hashtag save our stages has also amplified this. So again, I know I kind of joked we did this, but obviously it's in concert
in
concert with these other, you know, initiatives. And so we're really excited to say 5 million is now for all of Wisconsin, large and small. And the gist is as long as you've been operating since March 1st of last year, you're registered with the Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions, and have a standing that is, affirmative with that, that you're a 501c3 tax exempt, non-governmental organization, nonprofit, and you operate for the benefit of the public. And your primary mission is a production, presentation, or exhibition of cultural disciplines such as music, dance, literature, theater, and the visual arts, or items of environmental and scientific interest that gets you eligible for this. And so, David, the advice is file early, file often, arts and culture groups.
That's right. And I think, too, it's important to note that while $5 million from the state's allocation of this $5 million grant from unspent CARES dollars is incredible. And given that, you know, we've talked in the episode with Joe Pietrangelo, given how low we are in the state, in the nation, in public arts funding. This is an incredible step, but it's not enough. And there's still unallocated CARES dollars to be allocated. And our state elected officials really, really need to hear from you. They need to continue hearing from you. I think to Mac's point, given that, you know, we generated those thousands of messages, you know, the tan suit debacle that launched thousands of email messages, we need more of them. And our governor and our state elected officials, they need to continue to hear from you about how important this is. And so you can go to our website, you can thank our governor and lieutenant governor for the 5 million, but then also urge them to do more, because there are more unallocated CARES dollars back there that, by the way, need to be spent.
Yes. And also to tease up an upcoming episode, this grant is being managed by the Department of Administration, and that's helmed by Secretary Joel Brennan, and we'll actually have him in an upcoming episode very shortly to discuss this, and we'll also be hectoring him in real time to make sure we get some more money along the way. So just letting you know, this is news. We're excited about this news, but this is the beginning, y'all. We need to make sure and keep fighting for our arts and culture groups. So thanks again for the listeners. Thanks for those that helped generate, again, 1,600 pieces of correspondence to our state assembly people, our state senators, our elected Congress people, as well as our senators and governors and lieutenant governors. So that's exciting news, and let's press it. Let's keep pressing the urgency of it. So
don't make me get back in a tan suit.
Don't make David look like he was a top seller at Butcher Honda or whatever, and he moved the most CRVs. Please don't. Although there is a part of me that, you know, I enjoyed razzing him about tan suit. I don't have a tan suit, so I just have a tan T-shirt that has a tan tuxedo painted on it. So that's the closest thing I have to that. That being said, there's no real good pivot out of Ernest Snark outside of what are we talking about today? What are we talking about today is everything's happening, obviously, you know, that is going on, and the increased urgency around, you know, brought on by the uprisings. You know, the uprisings were launched, you know, in response to the deaths of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and unfortunately the names keep going on, right? And people keep marching because of that. But I would also invite alongside that, right? One of these issues along with this notion of racial equity, right? How are we looking at making sure that our country is inclusive? Our country provides opportunity for all of its people, right? So it's not just being treated under the law, but it's also thinking about how are all of our Americans, right? All of our folks, included in the economy, included in education, included in the workforce, et cetera, right? And so this has come to the arts and culture scene, right? As well as the notion of how are we making sure that all, and bring it back to Milwaukee, right? How do we make sure that all Milwaukee is seen on stage or seen on screen or heard? Or you know, how do we make sure that they have the opportunity to also be supported and created and amplified? So to that end, we're excited to focus the rest of our episode today in conversation with our guest, May Adrales, who is directing. She's the Associate Artistic Director at the Milwaukee Rep. And she's also producing, if you will, this event that's happening on September 9th in partnership with the Milwaukee Black Theater Festival. The Milwaukee Rep is hosting 2020 Vision for Milwaukee Arts, a one-day virtual conference, 1 to 4 p.m., Central Time on September 9th. You can hit it on Zoom. It's going to include industry and local leaders, as well as a panel discussion and a debut of an original commission by the Milwaukee Rep, free and open to the public. And so we've got local leaders like Brent Hazelton, Deanna Tillish, Bronzeville Arts Ensemble Artistic Director Sherry Williams-Pennell is going to be on it, as well as Michael Unger from Skylight. But we've also got some national folks like Idris Goodwin from the Colorado Springs Fine Arts Center is going to keynote, as well as addresses from the founder of the local Milwaukee's Black Theater Festival, Malkia Stampley, and Katina Cole of Empower Theater Group, and DeMonte Henning of Lights, Camera, Soul. So this is a really exciting afternoon, and May is the person that has put it together. In addition to that, just want to throw it out, May is quite a prolific and talented director herself. She also, before coming to become the Associate Artistic Director of the Milwaukee Rep, served as the Director of On-Site Programming at the Lark Play Development Center in New York, as well as served as the Artistic Associate at the Public Theater. Also has taught at Yale, has also worked, you know, at Juilliard, the American Conservatory Theater. Just a prolific director, but also this notion of inclusion and opportunity is incredibly real for her as a first generation Filipino American who's made it in this business. So we're excited to have May after the music break to talk about her journey, but also more importantly, talking about why we need to have this conversation around inclusion in our field today.
May your dreams protect you.
May, welcome to the pod.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
This is so fun to be able to speak with you. I know we met last fall. It feels like 10 years ago.
Yeah, at least a lifetime ago.
It's so exciting to be able to have you here, particularly with the 2020 Vision Conference next week. So thank you for making the time.
Yeah, I'm excited. And thank you for your involvement in it.
Awesome. Yeah, this is quite the quid pro quo, because you're like, hey, David, can you be on the panel? And David's like, yeah, just get to come on the pod. And it's like, the transaction has been made, right? So we are good. We are now even. No, and I'll think seriously, I have to say, May, like, first of all, Dave, when David shared your correspondence, his first thing he forwarded to me, he goes like, there's another one of us out here. There's another one. And then we went to the wall in our office, and then we added you to the wall. It's
a great wall. There's a wall? There's an Asian wall?
It's a metaphorical wall. It's a metaphorical wall.
It's in our hearts.
It's a wall in our hearts. It's a wall I keep around my heart to keep people up. No, but all things seriously, we're just so excited. And our theme is joyful abundance, right? Like that's the work theme. That's what we think about arts and culture. And I have to say, on a personal level, to see a Filipina in the role that you have, and I'm like, why don't I know? Like, why wasn't I get the push notification on my phone when one of our people make it? I was really mad. First of all, I was really mad. And then I got
Mom didn't send you a text?
Well, no, because like one, my mom and dad don't really understand what I do for a living. And two,
neither does mine, but they're very, very proud. Okay,
we're going to get to that. All right. So anyways, May, just the first thing I want to note for our lovely audience is, like, you can go to your website and see that you've been interviewed many times. In fact, you've been interviewed so many times, like the podcasts aren't even posted anymore. It's like, it was so in the past. Like there's like the Library of Congress has a wing to you. So one of the challenging things is, one, this is a prolific and talented person. So don't botch this thing, Mac. All right. Don't ask stupid questions. Two, it's just amazing, you know, to know like you're here in this town. I'm like, oh my God, I'm just so talented. It's so great to have you here. So I'm going to do my best to ask you questions that don't bore you. But then again, you're a talented performer, so we wouldn't know anything. So I did my homework. Thanks for putting together a great press page that made it easy to find things about you. A constant theme is the power of storytelling, which is why you do what you do. And I was really curious, what was the earliest memory of a story that really resonated with you? And what was your experience of experiencing that story?
I, you know, this question gives me some pause, because I'm trying to think, like, what is that story? How did it influence me so much that it influenced my entire
career? I guess you'd have second guessed yourself and rethink
exactly,
your whole being.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly. Good. That's what I'm about.
You know, I think every family has its story, and every family has its own lore. Mm-hmm. And even though my parents, who very fiercely did not want me to go into the arts, that wanted me to be a doctor or a lawyer, and tried very, very hard for that, I think they influenced me the most, because it's their origin story, which is how they came to the States, which I think is what influenced me. So my parents came over as students from the Philippines. My dad was in his residency as a doctor. My mom was a nurse, and they left the Philippines with the goal to come back, but without their parents actually knowing. They came all the way to New York.
It's almost like career eloping. That's like a career elopement. Like, I'm
exactly.
not elope my career.
They had a bunch of friends that they were going to go with. And this is a story that I remind them when they question some of my life choices. I'm like, at least I told you. You left your country and didn't even tell them.
Wow.
But my dad will talk. He had, my mom, of course, had a big suitcase because, you know, Filipinos, shoes, the stereotype is real. But my dad will often say he just had a very, very small bag, and he was wearing his only suit.
Wow.
And they came over, and while they were working, Marcos declared martial law and they actually couldn't come back. So then that kind of threw in their, they had to work to their work visas, their student visas had expired. Mm. So that's how they sort of landed in Appalachia, Virginia through a series of job
opportunities. Not a first pick is what you're saying, May. That was not a first pick. That was kind of like, wait, we can't go back home. Where can we work?
Appalachia.
Appalachia.
I think like they often tell this story and they talk about how they didn't have any dishes and that they would use their like the credits that they got like at the gas station to get their glasses. So they
You would get like you buy 2 gallons of gas.
Right.
And you get, like silverware. You get like stemware. That was like a business model of the American petroleum industry. Yeah, I totally remember this. Yeah,
it did them very well. And so I think that that story of just their adaptability and also that they still saw everything as a way, as progress and as a way forward for them. I mean, they used all of this, what you could look at as complete adversity. They lost their country. They had to, they couldn't go back. They were stranded, but they basically found a new beginning and everything. And I think that really influenced me in terms of just how I go about life and how I, you know, pursue, they really pursued the American dream. And I think in that kind of resilience is something that influenced me.
Now, May, when they told that story, was that after when you were ungrateful? We came over. How could you want to be an actress? We bought 10 gallons of gas so you could drink orange
glasses.
Like, is that, exactly. You know, like, was that story on the fire? You know,
exactly.
And like, come kids. And hear
they just communicate that story through the sort of like glowering Asian dad look, silent look.
Yes, it was silent. I mean, and again, apologies to David on the call. Apologies to, on the pod, or apologies to some of our listeners. There's going to be some moments. This is going to be very deep cut Filipino, which, you know, is often a story that's often told in media, the Filipino story, right? Like, oh, totally. We know that story. But I think a lot of times, like, I would not get in trouble. I'm the oldest of two. And I have a younger sister who like never got to do stuff because that was the gender norms in our role. Like older brother. Yeah. Go out till curfew, whatever. Younger, you're in the house until what, right? So that maybe you're nodding. But the thing about it is, like, I did not want to get in trouble.
I think that only because we're a family of all girls.
Have that dynamic. The thing about it in my family also is that, like, I didn't want to get in trouble. Like, you know, like, I didn't want to break any rules. It was kind of like very much straight and narrow because I knew my parents would flex the story of, like, we came all this way. We didn't come all this way, fill in the blank. You know, like, and I just, that would crush me, like, to know, like, if they had to break that story out. So that's, you know, for you to tell that powerful story, like, I sometimes wonder if, like, it was wielded, like, because, again, in my family, guilt. You know, I don't think that's one culture. Like, a lot of cultures use that really well. And that was wielded like, you know, katana blades, effective katana blades by, like, a master.
So my sort of reflecting back to the lore of my family, right? My parents came here, and this is the story they always tell, right? That they came to America with $400 in their pocket and a baby, me. And, you know, growing up, I was like, oh, whatever. Like, that's dumb. You know, I would do that. And then now as an adult, I'm like, I wouldn't move to Waukesha with $400 in my pocket or whatever the 40-year equivalent is, right? $1,000 or whatever it is. Like, that just seems so crazy. And yet they landed in San Francisco where my dad's mom, where my grandmother had already lived for a little bit. So, like, there was sort of a social support around them already. So Mac obviously grew up in the suburbs of Chicago. You grew up in Appalachia. So I texted him this morning and I was like, God, as Asians, we had it pretty good growing up in these places. But yet we also still experience otherness, right? And so I'm curious for you growing up in Appalachia, when did you first experience that? And what was that experience like, growing up in Virginia?
I think every day I truly experienced otherness.
Oh, it was. It really was clear for you.
It was very clear. I mean, like even to like, you know, you go to kindergarten and there's like a party, like end of the year party, and everyone's like bringing in their like their food from home, like some cupcakes or some brownies or things like, you know, my mom brings in babinka or like adobo. what's a party without adobo? And I remember like as a kid, because these are foods that I loved, I would just, you know, not think anything of it. But, you know, as I got a little bit older, like second, third grade, you start to get really embarrassed of your heritage. So I think it was always an something that I was very, very aware of, and also just feeling like, you know, you get the regular taunts of just, you look different, your parents, you know, sound different, you know, there's a different language that's spoken at home. So you're very aware of it. I think in a way I'm grateful for that, all of those, I don't know, childhood bullying, because it made me a storyteller, because I'm always looking on the outside in. Mm. So I kind of embrace like the idea of being an outsider, and all the stories that I tell as a director, they're always are from this outside in perspective, like what it's like to be the outlier in a society, what it's like to be an outsider that's trying to affect change when you're outside of it. So I think really that experience was helpful, even though it was deeply, deeply painful.
Now at home, did you speak your parents' language, or how did that work in your house?
You know, I'm the youngest of four girls. Okay. And so my parents at the beginning, you know, they taught my oldest sister. They would they would speak to her in Olongo, which is
Olongo, yeah, okay. Gotcha.
And I think it got really hard for them. Because first of all, when they first moved after they left the New York region, they went to West Virginia. Yep. And then they moved to a slightly bigger city where I grew up in, just over the border in Virginia. Yeah. It makes no sense. Yeah. But anyway, they felt like it was just too hard for her to navigate those two cultures. So like by the time that I was born, 10 years later, it was like, you know, they were much more about integrating us. And so I regrettably only speak like a 4 year old, in Olongo, but you know, but there's a little bit of a mixing and matching.
Yeah. Or I can pick up the Spanish influences sometimes, at least in Bisayan and Tagalog, right at home where I grew up. And my bit was always like, I know a little Bisayan. I know, clean up. And why didn't you go to law school? Like, that's what I know. Right. Like that's, and that always crushes every time. Like, yeah. But, the other thing I remember, my, you know, Dodong in my house, it was Dodong. I don't know if Indai, again, maybe different languages than Bisayan, right? Like for the eldest son or the daughter. And I remember going to school, and sometimes, you know, my parents would show up and they would call me Dodong. And I remember feeling like the heat on my neck as my white, you know, mainly white classmates were like, what did they call you? And I'd be like, cut it, mom, you can't, you know, like, even though, you know, that's what you did at home. There was almost like Mac in school, but in this house, I'm this. And so for me, it was this duality, you know, of where am I? It was, after a while, it's like code switching. Like it wasn't, you know, I got so used to it that I wasn't even cognizant that I was switching. And I remember specifically trying to lose the accent of my mom and dad, like in elementary school, like how they sounded, I'm sure I sounded like. And I really tried to, if not unlearn language, really formalize, or, you know, really be with the language of it. And again, my last bit I'll share is that my wife's family are from India. So she's born here. I was born here. And we both commented at times, like when we would work with our parents and we'd be at restaurants and we'd order for them sometimes. And it is this notion of like, because of their accent, you know, like it doesn't dawn on us, like, you know, they navigated a whole culture, like in a second language, like just because they don't crush English. It's funny that I'm like, she's going to have the French voice. It's a, you know, like, I don't, you know, like, it's just such a thing, like to your point. Yeah. And And it, yeah, just the arrogance sometimes. Of,
yeah, of I know, it. I know. Well, that doesn't go by my parents. My parents are very irritated when I do that.
Yeah, right. It's like, don't you understand that?
I did turn the otherness and the stereotypes yeah. of Asians to my advantage, or my family did, because my dad is a doctor. He established this private practice, and he was like hell bent on having one of his daughters follow in his footsteps. Mm. And so at a young age, like when we were in high school, like 14, 15, we worked for him at his office assisting in like minor surgeries. And and he would just say, oh, do you mind if my daughter takes out your sutures? And they would just look at me and be like, that's fine. And it's like, because I was Asian, yeah. and Asians, and all the Asians they knew were doctors.
Yeah.
Somehow this was actually okay. Keep in mind, I was only like 15 years old.
Oh, oh my God.
That's I'm imagining you like in the corner and you're like reading Teen Beat and like doing your nails and you look up like, fine. And you walk over and then you do the suit. Then you just kind of go back to like what you're doing
before. Exactly. You know, like, exactly.
Oh,
shrug.
Yeah. Oh, that's so funny.
So, you know, again, I appreciate you sharing these stories. We're going to get to the conference. Trust me. I think it's all building. I think it's all going to come together. But this notion of you were in the nonprofit public sector, worked for the Council on Foreign Relations, you know, a small mom and pop nonprofit, and then changed paths and committed to theater full time. Right. So, and you had mentioned that you had to overcome, or I'm assuming, you know, your parents messaging you saying, yeah, I don't know if this is a good idea. Right. Like, or probably not a good idea. And then lots of crying and wailing about it. Were there other gates you kind of had to pass in your mind before you jumped into something fully? And what were those?
Yeah, I mean, that whole story is actually really how I just pivoted and then fiercely, like 100% in, all in. I knew from this experience of working for my dad that I did not want to be a doctor. So I was sort of on this law trip. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to go to law school afterwards. And this is how I was working at the Council on Foreign Relations. And I was very interested in pursuing social justice. But simultaneously, I was also, working in theater relentlessly, you know, just off hours. It was still my hobby. But at the Council on Foreign Relations, it all came to a head because two things happened in 1 week. One, I was doing the New York Fringe Festival with a show that I was writing and directing. And so that was going on. And then I was also working at this not-for-profit think tank. And my bosses pulled me into their office and they had a stack of papers that were just like 4 books high of basically all of these things that I had done while I was in the office, and they fired me.
What?
Because basically the list of transgressions that I had done were using their copier, which I was using for the scripts that I was doing for my show downtown, making phone calls. They had a log of all the phone calls I was making. Wow. Because I was using my office as a casting office. Wow. The theater. Wow. And then to make it worse, I was also at the New York Fringe Festival. You don't have like a theater where you can like store props. So I was lugging my props back and forth, and they were in my office. So I was using it as this big storage space. Oh, and I was doing this big feminist opus. So I was, you know, in this were like this life-size cloth doll. Wow. It was like this avant-garde thing. Wow. With all these crazy props. And so they very kindly said, you know, We don't think that your focus is really on the foreign relations. We think that you might be a theater director. And so that happened simultaneously. I got my first New York review, which said that where I failed as a writer, I made a triple fold as a director. Wow. And so both of those things happened. And then the following week, my bosses at the Council on Foreign Relations did like me, even though they didn't think I was a good fit. Yeah. They threw me a farewell party after firing me.
Yeah.
And it was a surprise farewell party. So I walked into the common room and there was like, congratulations on being a theater director. Oh. And I was like, I guess I'm a theater director now.
That's a great story. It's like,
oh my gosh.
How it all started. And then after that, I just said, okay, I'm going to walk over to theater walking. I'm going to do this. And then I just went, you know, balls to the wall.
Wow.
It's almost like they did you a favor, right? I mean, like when you started,
you made the CFR look really good there, by the way, in a way that I never would have expected. Like, what a thoughtful.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've quite candidly, like I've been in situations where I've worked with folk because I've worked in, I worked at Public Allies for many years. So a lot of times you'd work with young people coming into the field. Right. And so I've had the situations where I've had, I know what it's like in their position going, you know what? They don't want to be here. And how do we bring, like, I could totally empathize with like what they're going through, even though in the moment you're like, what? Like but like for them, how they executed, I was just like, wow. So I'm struck by that. And it's almost like the path was laid in front of like, May, there's nothing else we can do for you outside of like,
yeah,
you know, and so you took it, you embraced
and to throw you a party, right? And also throw you a good firing party, right?
Which is
the first time I've ever heard of that ever happening.
That's awesome.
It's incredible.
It's like, why is this happening? It's like, it feels so wrong.
Big old
yes.
box they hand you know, it to you. And it's like,
when I was out in Los Angeles, doing basically the same thing, right? Like running a small theater company, going to auditions, trying to like get plays up and everything else. I also had a part-time day job at the Jewish Federation of Greater LA, which is where I sort of cut my teeth doing government relations. And your story reminded me so much of me like sneaking around printing scripts and like doing that thing, right? That every grinding theater artist who has a day job does. And I was so terrified that they would have like the counter on the Xerox machine or like be reading my emails to the co-artistic director at the small theater company I was at, that or sending scripts around or whatever. But that never ever happened to me. But you articulated like my worst nightmare, like basically from 2000
every copy,
to like 2000.
Every copy.
Yeah, that's right. That's so. And you also got fired. Right?
But it's odd. It's almost like that scene from the up in the, what was that with George Clooney?
Up in the air?
Up in the air. You know, because they fire people.
Yeah.
That was like the best example of that. That was the best. Listen, you're going to start the rest of your life, May. Honestly, you are. And you might not feel it, but you are. This is going to be the best thing ever. And like they, you know, that's a bit for in that role, but that was real for you. Let's fast forward a bunch. I mean, you've been around the block. I don't know how we're going to have time to, it's going to be an hour just to do your CV. So we're just gonna have to, but we'll fast forward to Milwaukee. And I read that you consider Milwaukee your artistic home. And I would love to hear, what does it take? What did it take for Milwaukee to be considered your artistic home?
I really attribute this to, I guess, Mark Clements and his, you know, the artistic director who had just come on to Milwaukee Rep at the time, you know, really give me a chance because this happened, I guess, 10 years ago. I had only just begun working at a large regional theater level. I'd had one show at the Goodman and then I was about to do something at After Show Louisville. But you know, my career thus far had been working south of 14th Street in New York. So I was still hustling. But we met at a theater festival at After Show Louisville and we just got to just really talking. It was just people, what interested us and what you know, inspired us. And then I think like maybe a month later, he was like, I have a show for you to direct. I don't know that much of your work, but I have a good feeling about this. Mm. And it went really, really well. Mm. And so since then I've been, you know, invited back to direct at the Rep. In 2017, then I came on and as the associate artistic director, and I was working mainly as a I was still working in New York as a freelancer. And so I was kind of dividing my time between New York and Milwaukee and then came on full time in September.
I mean, at the risk of being, I don't know, maybe too literal, in the sense of, you know, I consider Milwaukee home because that's where I reside. I lay my head here, you know, I pay a lot of taxes here, right? And my kids have
come up here. But when I think of artistic home, right, it's beyond sort of the physical, right? And it's the mental, it's the spiritual in some way. And so I'm really curious for you, like, what would it mean? And again, I know you're not speaking for the artists, but when someone says like, this is my artistic home, what do you think there's the elements of a place that intersect with who you are and your journey so far that you described and what resonates there?
I mean, I think it's the, I mean, I guess I can speak for me, which I think other artists might say the same, but a place where you can truly take risk and you can explore your own curiosities and be vulnerable. I mean, and you have the freedom to fail, and knowing that you are still supported and that your artistry is still valued. I think that there's my story with Mark taking a chance on me has happened with a lot of artists there. And so I think like it provides a supportive environment for people to, you know, take those artistic risks. And, you know, as a freelancer for so long, you call it artistic home when they ask you back.
I think to also like plumb a little bit deeper on that though, do you think there are elements about Milwaukee and Milwaukee's creative community that could potentially make that true, right? The element, the conditions that you just outlined about like being able to be vulnerable, being able to fail, having still some supports. Are there, have you seen like some of those conditions that are unique to Milwaukee that sort of create that possibility here?
Yes. I mean, I think one of the other things is like feeling like your art is valued and feeling it has an impact and that you are making a difference is a huge thing for artists to come back. And I think that Milwaukee has that potential. And I've seen it happen, especially in student performances, where it's people see themselves reflected on stage and they see the power of story, and it transports them and changes their way of thinking. And so I think the regional theater really has the power to do that because they're so rooted in their community and they can speak directly. So I think that, I think like the city of Milwaukee is kind of ripe for that. I mean, we're like before COVID, you know, we're going to be that nexus point in, you know, in an election year with the DNC coming here.
This was supposed to be our hot the girl Bucks. Summer, May.
Yes, I know.
Hot girl summer. It was. Yeah. On Earth 2, it is. The one we're in, we're figuring out how to stream stuff. So, right. But in our world, the Bucks are down 0-2. To the
this is like upside down world, right? This is the fifth dimension. Yeah.
So you're enrolled as the associate artistic director, and we've definitely spoken a lot about your excellence in directing, in pulling out the compelling pieces of a piece and how to have the nexus of that come together. But you're also directing a different type of event, which is this event. Do you like my transition? Do you like how it goes?
Very good. Like, yeah.
That's yes. So 2020 Vision, Future of the Milwaukee Arts on September 9th, is this opportunity to envision what does an inclusive future look like in Milwaukee Arts. So would love to hear, how did this event come together as you're doing all these other things, like trying to produce plays and all this?
Yes.
Was this part of your role, or is this like extra? Like, you know, this is something, no, we got to do this. Can you tell me how it came together?
I think it's all kind of extra right now. I mean, when we shut down our building in March, and in April, we started pivoting to doing online programming. So I became sort of the virtual online content producer, which has been great. I've we've commissioned writers and actors to do original pieces, commission musicians to create, you know, original pieces for us. And so that's been really rewarding. And so yes, that's pivoted. And the conference actually came about because Malkia Stambley, Sherry Williams-Pinnell, and DeMonte Henning, with Brent Hazelton, who's the architect of our chamber, you know, did this amazing thing. They recognize that there is a there's not a platform for Black artists right now, and in a city of festivals, there needs to be a Black theater festival.
Yeah.
And so they really came up with this beautiful vision for amplifying Black voices. Mm-hmm. And Milwaukee Rep, you know, wants to be supportive of that vision. And those artists also have a close connection to the Rep. And so I, in talking with Brent and Malkia, suggested that, you know, why don't we create sort of a culminating event where we can bring people together? Mm-hmm. And so that's really how it came to be. And then I thought to myself, great, we made that happen. Now I have to figure out what this looks like.
Well, good on you for being the for trying to figure this out, right? Because we've been just on the Imagine side, we've been thinking about how do we do events, like whether it's an annual event or some other convening, and we're just like, we're so ambivalent about all of it, but because of the current limitations, right, of our reality. But I think it's so important that this thing is happening later on this week, because I think to your point earlier about like how do our arts institutions and arts organizations tell stories that are reflective of what the city looks like, right? That sort of creates that sense of, I hope, right, belonging and inclusion that I think we all sort of experienced growing up, right, that we talked about earlier in the episode. So it's really great.
Oh, it couldn't have come at a better time right now.
That's right.
May, let's play fill in the blank. I'll know that this event was as successful as I hoped because?
When all of the theaters that are involved, or the arts organizations promote this festival for next year. And it continues and hire all these amazing artists that are here locally. Mm-hmm.
That sounds like a good result. I think
we can join in that. Yeah, no, that's exciting. We
join in that. What's the difference between directing a play and directing a conference?
Oh.
See, directing a conference is my world, right? Tell me about that. How's that working for you?
Well, you know, like when you're directing a play, you have the script and you know how it's going to go. Directing the conference is more about like improv, and it's like, oh my gosh. And then of course, right now we're just like, one of the main questions I'm asking everyone is like, how is your internet? Reliable internet.
What keeps you up at night is the sound of someone's voice getting hung up in Zoom. It's like, and just you hear that for like 20 seconds and you're just,
right.
That's the biggest nightmare.
It's like somebody going up on lines, right, on stage is the Zoom latency or something.
Exactly. It's so painful.
We're so grateful, May, you took the time in the run-up, right, to this big event, and that we could use our platform to hype it up. Our mighty, you know, we're 250th in the country. I don't know if you know that, of arts podcasts are 250th.
Oh, so wow.
So if you do the math,
first of all, you're
right,
welcome.
If you think about like the amount of arts podcasts in the nation, New York's probably got 100, LA's probably got 100, right?
So Chicago's like got 49. 50.
So we're basically number one.
Yeah, we're number one of all these other markets. I think so. I'm going to say number one Asian American arts podcast. Come at me, everybody. Yeah. Come at me, LA. Let's go. Let's do this.
Get us in the comments on that one. Yeah, we would love to see. At us. Totally at us on
Come
that
at
one.
Me. Yeah, because we have May. We have May Adrales, and that makes us officially the best Asian American podcast. We have the ability. We also, what makes us great is we have the ability to make our guests the czar of arts and culture in Milwaukee, which means you'd have the power to make policy happen. It only lasts as long as the remainder of this episode. It's weird. We don't ask for the power, May. We just accept it. We're going to declare you the new czar. What is your first and most likely most important policy that you will advance in this role?
I will make theater, to attend theater completely free. Mm-hmm. And also, can I tag on to this?
It's your world.
I'm the czar. The czar. It needs to, theater's really need to be like the meeting place. I mean, that's what it was in the Greek theater, and need to be a place where people gathered and they exchanged ideas. So the, I think it's called the Archon, what it was in Greek theater, where people gathered. And so in addition to making theater free so that we eliminate cost as a barrier to participation, we also transform all the lobbies of theaters into awesome coffee shops and a place of gathering, so people actually see it as a neighborhood place where they can come, and that, you know, people, there might be musicians there. But I'm missing in theaters with all these very fancy lobbies. And they're so inaccessible, like people don't know that they can come in. And this is a service, this is a not-for-profit theater. This is a service that we give to the community. So we have to make it so. So free coffee.
free coffee. This is incredible.
Free theater.
Yes. Drawlace 2020 right here. This is it. It's happening. Four more years. You know, and all seriousness, May, you remind me of the time where I went to I visited Congress, what's that building? Oh, my Congress teacher's excited for me. The Congressional Building, where to advocate for, in a previous life, I would advocate for national service, right? And you'd visit your elected rep.
There are a number of congressional buildings.
Yeah. There's okay, like right. Thank you. So you're not penalizing me because I'm like, there's a building, right? Capitol Hill. This is the Capitol Hill. But like, there's this moment when I walk in, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm not supposed to be here. And then I, like, my folks that were with me had to remind me, like, they work for you. They work for you. And that's what you're saying about the theater. Like some theaters, you walk in, it's just like, oh my gosh, do I belong here? I don't know. I have to be quiet. And it's like, no, this is our house, right? That's what you're saying. Like, what does it mean?
That's what I'm saying.
For people to be like, no, this is where our stories are told. And this is where we try to make sense of what's happening right now. And this is over at some coffee. And that's, how do we remind that? That's what I'm hearing. It's been a glorious rain, mate. And even though, you know,
it's over already.
I know it's real short.
It's so short. Again, I'm mad at myself more than you for this, because I think you're really worthy of it. I will say this, the legacy of your term is not forgotten. And I commit to, in our role at Imagine MKE, to carry this out. How do we make sure that theater is accessible? It's telling the stories. It's telling the stories from Milwaukee's perspective. It's telling the stories of Milwaukee, which make it such a powerful place. An awesome place, and that it's places that people want to be in, right? Not just Saturday night at 8 and 10, you know, 6 and 8, or maybe the 2 o'clock in the afternoon for the matinee, right? The people are there a lot. And we'll be sure to keep that legacy going, moving on. As we wrap up, got a plug, May, plug it. What else to plug? You, your website. Obviously, we got this event on September 9th.
Yes, please tune in to the September 9th, 2020 Vision.
Yeah.
For Milwaukee Arts Conference.
Anything else you want to plug?
And also, books, cookbooks. Milwaukee Black Theater Festival.
Milwaukee Black Theater Fest.
Still in the, you still have 1 week left to tune into some amazing online art.
Awesome.
I just bought my pass for the last week, so I'm super excited to attend next week.
Oh, great.
As am I. May? Thanks so much for your leadership. And thanks so much for, I muttered to myself, May's life is what I'd be like if I was more talented and brave. So thank you for living that out so I can vicariously see other Filipinos.
This is the power of representation, Matt.
This is the power of representation.
You're seeing the possibilities right now.
That's right. For you. That's it. I'm going to jump in the DeLorean, jump back 20 years back to Improv Olympic and go, I'm going to go audition for Staying Alive. and then imagine MK in that world will struggle because nobody knows that.
We'll just disappear, right?
I accept that. Sorry, I'm going to say, David, in the Back to the Future situation, I'm okay with Imagine MK not existing if I'm doing movies. I'm okay with that. Like, I can live with that.
We're going to note that in your performance review for next year. So just
stand by.
That one.
I stand by it. I have morals. I stand on that. May, you didn't need to witness any of that. Take care. Thanks.
Yes, thank you. May your heart be unbreakable, unshakable. May you always see what you are. You are beautiful.
There's not enough time. That was too fast.
I really enjoyed sort of being a fly on the wall and watching you two trade stories of growing up Filipino in America.
I know, right? I mean, gosh, it's such a story that's told all the time. So I thanks for everybody for enduring yet another example of y'all getting hit over the head. Of course, I'm being sarcastic. It was such a privilege and honor to have her on. I honestly could have traded those stories all day. But as well as we left, not that we left anything on the cutting room floor, there's a lot of questions around just the compelling works that she's helped bring into light and directed. Amazing work. And so I guess I really am struck by the notion that when I think of May, I think of if I was braver and more talented, I would be May Adrallis really quickly. It's hard for me not to reflect on the choices I've made in my life. And for whatever reason, I didn't lean into it as much. But I guess when I see May, it's a little bit of jealousy, but also admiration in someone who took that risk and leaned into her talent and trusted her genius. And if anything, I'm rooting for her to keep doing it. So that's for me what I'm taking away from the conversation. I'm so delighted she's in our city to do the work.
Yeah, you know, I was reminded of my acting teacher in high school who would always start every class off telling us, reminding us to not have a backup plan, because if we had a backup plan, we would fall back to it. We'd use it. You know, I think for me, while I never really had a backup plan, like I was able to sort of like backdoor into these different careers that have sort of served as backup plans, and the comfort that has come from them has sort of led me to this path, right? So similar, like I think that her story about being fired from the Council on Foreign Relations in the most nice way possible, as almost like a gift, was just I think serendipitous. Right now, I find myself wondering, like, if I had met her and she had told me that story, like, you know, 20 years ago or 15 years ago, or contemporaneously, like what different choices I would have made, right? Sort of like you, like what different choices would we have made if we had seen a different alternative for us out there?
I really think when my past life at Public Allies, which I worked for many years and I loved working there, but I'm surprised that they didn't do that to me at some point. Because I'm sure at times I was like, I want to be somewhere else, like trying something. Like I'm sure that, right? And I don't know, to their credit or maybe to their detriment, they never, you know, I don't know how I'd have received it. I mean, I hope I would have been open eyes and have been like, oh yeah, you're right. You know, you're like, you're being braver than I am in this moment. But but yeah, I mean, it's a credit to her and credit to the, I still think that's a win for the Council on Foreign Relations, at least from our podcast point of view. I'm like, yeah, thumbs up.
At the beginning of this, did you ever imagine that we would ever name check the Council on Foreign Relations on our podcast?
No, but I didn't think that. I also didn't think that talking about loaves of bread was going to probably be the most resonant conversation from the podcast ever. Right. So,
and for our listeners, right? The thing that has generated the most.
That has generated the most heat. By the way, yeah, listeners, keep talking to us. Keep emailing us. We love it. And we look forward to continuing the conversation. To that end, thanks again for listening to this episode. I was just sort of thinking about David. We've already like looked ahead. I'm really excited about the folks we got coming on. No shade to the people that have been on recently, but I think we're finally picking up our stride. So much. I think the AV Club, right, would be reviewing our episodes. Or like, I think these guys are finally getting it. I think they're finally getting it. And so stay tuned for that. As we're going to have folks like Joel Brennan from the Department of Administration on. We're going to also have some more elected reps. I'm not going to drop any names yet because it's not official, but we've already got some buzz. So, you know, you want to listen, we're going to get those folks on and accountable, as well as some other dynamic artists and arts admins that are doing some really exciting work. This is where it's happening. So we're glad you're listening to us. To that end, David, as we pivot towards the end, thanks again for listening. Be sure to rate us, share a positive review, help people find us. And email us at pod@imaginemke.org. Also, I'm going to change the hashtag, David. I'm going to do it right now. I know I didn't run this by you. I'm going to do it right now. Make it #imaginaryfriendmke, because I did a Google search of #imaginaryfriend. Ooh, it's rough out there.
Too much.
there's some QAnon type action on there. I don't want our brand tied up with that ish. So let's go hashtag imaginary friend MKE to all the people out there. Tweet it out, Instagram it out. Again, use that to let us know. Be the conversation on social. We'll be sure to retweet you, find you. And yeah, we're going to make you a friend of ours.
We're on Twitter and Instagram at imagine_MKE or Facebook at imagine_MKE. Make sure you listen to our pods in our podcast family, Arts Forward MKE, hosted by Lindsay Sheridan, and Black Imagination with Kenita Hickman and Antoine Carter. And don't forget, please don't forget to take action on our website to thank our governor and lieutenant governor for the $5 million grant, and also write another note to your federal elected officials telling them that they need to pass COVID-19 relief to ensure that our arts and culture frontline workers are protected through this continuing relief. You can find all that on our website at imaginemke.org.
Get on it, everybody. And until then, we look forward to talking to you next Tuesday. Bye.